Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telly. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Today, just how safe is our imported food? There's plenty of fresh processed food now coming into the country, fresh and processed food, I should say. So today we'll take a look at just what's involved in making sure foods like imported apples, for instance, are free from disease and nasty chemicals and generally just fine for us to eat. That's very soon. We've also got live music today from Darren Hanlon. It's been about 4 years since his last album. But this week he's been taking a fairly small and intimate live show to a couple of regional parts of New South Wales. So Darren will be in for a chat and a song today on Bush Telly. Well, it's one of the standout symbols of any trip to Queensland's north, that diamond yellow-shaped road sign with a big black picture of a cassowary on it. It is, of course, a warning that these colourful flightless birds that can grow to more than 2 metres tall are being wiped out by cars. It's actually estimated now that there are less than 1,000 of them left. That's why a national campaign is about to start that hopes to get more Australians doing something to save the cassowary. Jennifer Crose is Director of Conservation at Rainforest Rescue. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Only 1,000 left. Can we save the cassowary from that sort of numbers?
Look, I think, there's definitely a concern about its rapid decline population, but I do believe that we can make a difference. I mean, they do flourish quite well if they're, they've got the habitat to live amongst, but I think that's what this whole problem is we're finding that habitat loss and the fragmentation of this habitat is causing them to cross the road and be, potentially struck by a car.
Mm. So it is really car strikes that are the big issue at the moment?
Very much so. I mean, we've got a record of more than 60 that have been hit or killed or injured by road strikes, and that's just in the sort of Mission Beach, Tully and Ellerish areas. But we're also thinking that, with this constant degradation and habitat loss, with lowland tropical rainforest already, 85% gone, the biggest concern is where are these amazing birds going to live?
Mm. They are amazing birds, aren't they? They're quite critical to
the
forest overall, the rainforest in the north. Whereabouts are they still found?
So there's three known populations. So you've got a population up in Cape York that not much research has been done on. And then from Cooktown all the way north of Townsville is the distribution range of the southern cassowary, with known populations particularly around the Daintree and also around Mission Beach.
Okay, that's the southern cassowary. Is there one in PNG as well?
There are. There are two subspecies there, the dwarf cassowary and the wattled cassowary. And the southern cassowary, the Cassowaries cassowaries jansoni, is endemic to the far north Queensland wet tropics.
Mm, it's the southern cassowary you're trying to save here.
Yes.
What do we actually know about them? Because they're fairly shy by nature, aren't they?
Shy by nature, but definitely got this amazing character about them. And I think, particularly the local community Mission Beach have been privileged to be seeing these cassowaries roaming around their backyards. And each cassowary is different. They've all got a different cask, which is the helmet-like shaped hat, I guess, on top of their head.
Mm-hmm.
They've got this beautiful paternal nature with the father actually, taking over the role of sole carer. So women's lip is very, very much alive in the cassowary world.
But, what, the mum lays the egg and then goes on her way, does she?
Yes. So the father actually takes over the sole role, incubating the eggs for over 50 days and then looking after the little chick for up to 18 months, teaching it its life survival skills before the chick will go off and start living its own life, because they are, in fact, very territorial birds.
Yeah, they can be a little scary too, can't they, if you get on the wrong side of one?
Yeah, they can. And I think, the whole purpose of this campaign is to take away that stigma and to take away the sensationalism of, the world's most dangerous bird, when in fact, like you said, Cameron, they are a shy bird, and only when provoked, so particularly when it's got chicks, or only when it starts to feel threatened, will it start attacking? But there are really no known cases of that, with the exception of one early in the 1900s.
When a cassowary attacks, what does it do?
Well, it will, its claws or its feet will obviously be the biggest issue. It can run really fast, but I don't really know of many cases where that's happened. I mean, the one of the reasons why we're launching this campaign, and particularly at a community level, is due to the fact that they're becoming more prevalent around the road area and residential development, people have been hand-feeding the birds, and that's also because, you know, they've done the right thing in terms of supplementing it due to the cyclones that have happened. But now, unfortunately, you can get some habituation and familiarisation with the bird thinking that, you know, humans mean food. So one of the things that we're going out with is, you know, hand-feeding should be absolutely avoided, because obviously that is causing this conflict between humans.
That's a general rule for all wild animals,
absolutely.
Birds in particular, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I guess, you know, if you see this striking bird come across to your car and you're driving across to the Daintree or Mission Beach, then, you know, of course there's that tendency that you think, oh, wow, and you have seen other people do it before. And One of the things that we're really advocating is to not hand feed the birds, and definitely just, you know, admire them from a distance, because they do deserve to be given right of way and to slow down more than anything.
Do you think they are beautiful? Because they're interesting looking, but those feet on them, they almost look like they've got those novelty slippers on, yeah, the chicken feet on them.
But don't you think that's amazing, though? I mean, don't they look like, you know, feet from the dinosaur era? I do think they're beautiful. I've fallen absolutely in love with this iconic bird. They definitely don't deserve the negative rap that they have received. They play such a keystone role in rainforest ecological functionality and diversity.
Why? What do they do?
Well, they've got the ability, due to their digestive tract, they've got the ability to eat and germinate over 238 rainforest species of plant species.
Okay.
And many other species of animals don't have the capacity to do that, because some of these seeds are actually quite toxic. So you take them out of the picture, there's a chance that many seeds and plant species will not get a chance for seed dispersal and propagation.
We don't know of any other bird that disperses some of these seeds?
No.
It's the Kasper is remarkable for a number of reasons, isn't it? How close is it to being the biggest bird in the world?
Well, it's got its relatives. So it is, like you said, a ratite, meaning it's a flightless bird. So its closest relatives are, in fact, the ostrich and the emu, as well as the rare and the tinamou, but found in South America. But, you know, in terms of the biggest bird is the ostrich, followed by the emu, and the cassowary is third
but
it
biggest.
Is definitely definitely the most colorful, and you know, I'm not just saying that, but I do believe that they are amazing. But the whole flightless bird family, the whole ratite family, is quite interesting.
Do they actually have wings hidden in there?
There is absolutely, they've got this shows you how amazing evolution is. They do have vestigial wings, meaning that they've obviously evolved and they have become flightless due to the bulk of their weight. But if you look closely, there are these little chicken wings that are in fact wings hidden underneath that black plumage.
Little chicken wings that are just for show.
Well, you know, we don't see them, but they are there. And it just shows that, you know, that's how through evolution they've lost their chance of flight.
Yeah. Do you know how long they've been in Australia?
Well, you know, this is debatable, but I've had some experts come and verify this with me, and I've got obviously got my colleagues at the Wet Tropics Management Authority as well. It's known and recorded that they've evolved over 80 million years ago, so during that Cretaceous period. 80, yes, absolutely. And that, you know, they are...
That's dinosaur-type time.
Yeah, absolutely, dinosaur type time. And, and a great indication that a living legend and a living relic is living amongst us from the Gondwana era, you know, when Australia was part of Gondwana. And obviously, you know, the Wet Tropics region has got all the proof of having Gondwana relics and plant species still evident today.
Wow, okay. So it'd be a shame, I guess, if we lost them on our watch, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it just be? I would be, it would be a very sad state of affairs if, you know, our children's and children's children's were never able to see a cassowary up close and only could see them and identify them in picture books, which I think is unfortunately the case of many species at the moment.
A little bit about the campaign in a moment, but okay, we know they can't fly. It can be fairly wet in that part of Queensland. Can they swim?
They can swim. There's absolutely records and footage where they have been known to swim, absolutely. And they will cross creeks, especially when there might be fragmented habitat. They want to get from point A to B. Yes.
Okay, that's a surprise because they can weigh a fair bit. They look like a little wedge, which I see would work getting through the forest with that helmet and that wedge body. But swimming, that's a surprise.
Swimming, yeah, no, yeah. They can definitely get around.
Yeah. So the campaign, what will actually be involved with it?
So Rainforest Rescue's initiated the campaign to complement the work that we've been doing for the past 15 years in terms of rainforest conservation. And there was a real need for us to take action on this because I do believe that this iconic bird hasn't deserved the attention it deserves. And we wanted to align it to, well, we preserve the rainforest, we need to restore the rainforest, but we also want to do some species conservation, regardless of whether it's fauna and fauna. So we've decided that given the current situation of the southern cassowary, is to raise their profile and to make them the ambassador species and the voice of the rainforest. And working and collaborating with our key partners, the likes of the Queensland Environment Department, Heritage and Protection, as well as our Aboriginal Corporation partner, Girigan, Wet Tropics, and a number of zoos, over 20 zoos, as well as our business partner, Biopac, we're basically, we've created a public-facing awareness campaign of the bird. So if you were to go to the zoo anywhere around Australia, a participating zoo that has got southern cassowary, you will see a consistent sign with a consistent message about who am I, which is the tagline of the campaign, and to find out more about this amazing bird
so
and the role that it plays.
Yeah, so people are more aware of the situation. Just before I let you go, can you confirm or deny that this is actually the sound of a cassowary? Jennifer, that doesn't sound like a bird to me. Is that what a cassowary sounds like?
Yeah, look, they make a very booming sound. So, yes, absolutely they can sound like that. And funnily enough, on the website, which we're launching on the 17th of March, the savethecassowary.org.au, we have captured sound and we've got sound bites of different cassowaries, and it's all around booming. And it's fantastic. You wouldn't think a bird's got the capacity to have that kind of noise.
Sounds like a koala almost to me, that.
Well, they do have this booming, booming sound. So, yes, I mean, you'd be lucky, I think, if you heard that.
Yeah.
In the rainforest, but maybe frightened as well.
I would be. I'd be taking off at a rapid rate. All right. Look, good luck with the campaign, Jennifer.
Thanks for
telling us all about the cassowary.
Absolutely. Thank you, and look forward to speaking to you later.
Yeah, great. Jennifer Crose, who's a conservation scientist and director of conservation at Rainforest Rescue. So that campaign actually starts next week, but a bit of a sneak peek of what will be involved. Some of you are sharing your views and your sightings of cassowaries on our Facebook page at the moment. Monica says she saw one at Etty Bay, which I'm not actually familiar with where that is. Maybe let us know on Facebook, Monica. You're listening to Bush Telly. Cameron Wilson with you. Let's go from flightless birds to songbirds. Now, it's been known for quite some time that bird song is generally about declaring an interest in a member of the opposite sex or claiming a patch of land. But it's also been widely assumed that the singer is a male bird. But there's new findings now from researchers, and they're overturning assumptions that have been held for the last 100 years or more. Basically what this means is the dawn chorus that you woke up to this morning, it might have been sung by a female singer, not strictly a male bird. To learn more about this, I'm joined by Dr. Naomi Longmore, who's from the Australian National University's Research School of Biology. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Cameron.
How widely has it been accepted or viewed that songbirds are generally the males that we hear?
Well, it's a very pervasive view. It's been around ever since Darwin first used bird song as an example of sexual selection and triggered a whole plethora of studies on males singing to attract females. And it's so widespread that it's actually the textbook definition of bird song is that it's complex vocalizations produced by males during the breeding season. So it's actually defined as a male vocalization.
So where did that view come from? What was it based on?
Well, most bird research in the past has been conducted in Europe and in North America. And in those two regions, the songbirds mainly belong to a very recently evolved group called the Passerida. And the Passerida is a group where female song has generally been lost. So the perception amongst those researchers was that female song was anomalous or an aberration.
So what's different about Australia?
Australia is fascinating place to study songbirds because it's actually where songbirds evolved. So we've got a whole lot of ancient groups of songbirds here, and we've also got some of this very recent group, the Passerida, as well. But in all of those more ancient groups, bird song is very common.
When you say an ancient songbird, what sort of era are we talking about? How long ago?
Well, the songbirds evolved in Australia or Australasia in about 65 million years ago, and they evolved in this region for about 20 million years before they diversified and expanded to the rest of the world.
Okay, so a rich history there.
That's right.
So tell me how you've come to the finding that it's not necessarily then just the male that we hear in Australia. How did you reach this conclusion?
Well, working on birdsong as an Australian, you're very aware of this misconception in the literature, because I would read papers about birdsong being produced by males, and then I'd go out to do field work and be surrounded by female birds singing everywhere I looked. So I could hardly miss that anomaly.
Yeah, you realised there was a mistake in the literature somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, do you have a particular favourite?
Well, my favourite's the superb fairy wren, because that's my study species. Mm-hmm. And in that species, both the males and the females sing prolifically. And because the males are blue and the females are brown, you can easily see which sex is singing. In a lot of other birds where the sexes looked similar, people have missed the fact that females are singing. If they see a bird singing, they think it's a male. And in many species, we still don't actually know whether the females sing, because nobody's really looked at it before.
So here's a fairy wren here. Any way of knowing if that's a male or a female?
Well, actually, there is. The first that you played two songs there. The first one started with a series of trills, and that's a male-specific signature. So I know that at least that first song was sung by a male. If that signature's not there, you can't actually tell whether it's a male or a female. The males and females produce very similar songs otherwise.
Okay. Does this discovery, or that female bird songs sing as well, does it challenge what people think the role of the song actually is?
Well, it does, because the idea ever since Darwin first used bird song as a beautiful example of sexual selection is that males sing to attract females and to defend a territory. Mm. So quite a male-focused view.
It's all about conquest, really, isn't it?
It was exactly. It was all about competing with other males to attract females and being attractive to females. So that's what it was all about. But this discovery that female song is actually extremely common as well suggests that perhaps song has a broader use in terms of defence of nest sites, defence of food resources, competition between females as well as competition between males. So this all fits under a broad umbrella of social selection rather than sexual selection.
So it sounds like you've got a bit more work ahead of you now.
Absolutely. We've got to work out now why some females are singing and why others aren't. And
yeah.
That sort of thing.
And will that just be in Australia, or does this actually pose questions for the Northern Hemisphere as well?
Oh, definitely for both. And my collaborators in this research are based in North America and Europe, as well as in Australia. So we're all collaborating, and we'll probably next do a very broad scale analysis of what are the ecological variables that are related to female song. So we already know that non-migratory behaviour seems to be related to female song, and that it's more common in tropical regions. So we'll try and work out what factors select for maintenance of female song versus loss of female song.
We've been promoting a 360 documentary on Radio National, RN at the moment, all about the butcher bird. This is the butcher bird. That's one of the great songs, isn't it, Naomi?
Beautiful, absolutely yeah. Beautiful.
Do you know much about the butcher bird yet?
Well, it's another species where males and females both sing. Mm. Most of the birds that you encounter in most of the bush birds or the backyard birds in Australia, you'll find song in both sexes. Butcher birds are no exception.
Yeah, okay. It is a magnificent call, isn't it? It's one of my favourite. We were discussing them the other day, and we got a tweet at RN Bush Telly from Sandra, who was listening to the butcher birds at her place just as we were discussing them. So it was good to hear from Sandra. All right, well, look, good luck with the rest of your research, and we'll have to Have to talk again when we know more about female songbirds. Thanks a lot, Naomi.
Many thanks.
Dr. Naomi Longmore from the Australian National University's Research School of Biology. Just while we're talking about some of your comments on our Facebook and our Twitter feed, Emma has just put a picture up, a painting she's done of a cassowary that's it's got a red helmet on, so it's some artistic license there. It's a stunning picture. If you go to the facebook.com/bushtelegraph Facebook page, you will see it for yourself just there. Cameron Wilson with you, Bush Tally on RN and Radio Australia. Coming up next, we'll get the latest in rural news. We'll have live music for you very soon on Bush Telegraph. Darren Hanlon, who's a well-known singer-songwriter, a real storyteller in the music industry. It's been 4 years since his last album was released, but he has a new one about to be released in the coming weeks. But just in the lead-up to that release, he's been playing a couple of very small shows to, you could say, try out the material on crowds of 100 people or less. And one of those shows was in Wagga Wagga earlier this week, and there's one coming up in Candalow in southeastern New South Wales later in the week. So Darren will tell us all about that very soon. First, though, let's find out what's making rural news today. I'm joined by Kath McAlone. Kath, you've got more news coming out of ABARES, the economist telling us how much money everyone's making. We heard yesterday that some farmers, broadacre farmers, are making $17,000 a year, which didn't sound too good to me at all, but it's better news for dairy farmers.
Yeah, that's right. Dairy farmers can expect about a threefold increase in their farm cash incomes this financial year compared to last year. ABARES, the commodity forecaster, says that the average income will be $129,000. That is the average, though, and they expect that it will be slightly lower in northern Australia, where the drought is eating into profits there because farmers are having to buy in more feed for their cows.
$129,000, did you say?
Yeah, that's what they're saying, an average income of $129,000. Is that worth your while getting up at 5 a.m. each day?
It suggests to me that maybe the milk wars hasn't wiped a huge amount off some.
Yeah.
I know that figure will be skewed by those that just export dairy product rather than supply
from
the fresh
southern states.
Fresh product.
Yeah.
But it does sound like you'd get up for that.
Yeah, well, you'd be doing even better if you're in New Zealand because analyst Jo Bills, she's a dairy analyst with a group called Fresh Agenda. She says even though Australian dairy farmers will see that increase, they'll still be getting about 15% less than New Zealand farmers.
Australian farmers are quite rightly looking across the ditch and thinking, well, our prices are getting better, but not quite that good. New Zealand is very much focused on whole milk powder, the biggest import product for China, and that's really where a lot of the growth has been, particularly in the last 12 months.
Okay, so there we go. There's an example. If you export the powder rather than supply the fresh market, you might make a touch more. Kath, you told us recently about the Bengal fire in South Australia and how it's been threatening the timber industry there because the trees have all burnt down.
Yeah.
You've got some better news on that fire today.
Yeah, some good news. There had been some real concerns about native wildlife, particularly the yellow-footed rock wallaby, which was known to be in that area. And there was concerns that the populations of that rock wallaby would be destroyed by the fire, but some of the animals have now been spotted. Local Natural Resource Department Manager Trevor Naismith says the fire's also provided a chance for authorities to get in there and try and keep some pests out.
We're putting a helicopter up next week, firstly not only to survey the wallaby population, but we're actually very conscious of the need to get on top of some of the introduced competitors that we've had in that area for a very long time, and trying to find some good out of the fire, I guess, that it has presented us with an opportunity to get on top of our goats and deer that have caused problem in that area.
Mm. Okay, so still tough if you're in the timber industry, but good to hear that there is some positive news out of that fire. Now, you've got a new gadget for us. What on earth is a lamb probe?
Yeah, it sounds a little daunting. It's a new gadget that Meat and Livestock Australia are playing with, and they hope that it'll be able to give them some information about the eating quality of lamb.
Mm-hmm.
It's been devised in Denmark. It's this invention, and it's sort of a handheld probe that sends electric currents through meat, and it could help processors to improve how they grade lamb for eating. The MLA's Richard Apps says the industry has been looking for this sort of technology for a long time.
Essentially, it's got a series of prongs or needle-like prongs which can be pushed in through the fat into the meat tissue. There's an electrical current goes through those prongs. There's more resistance to the flow of that current depending on how much fat there is in that tissue, increasing the capacity to degrade lamb on eating quality.
And so I thought by probe it would mean you put it maybe in its mouth, but into the flesh.
Into the flesh, yeah. So it might change the way you think about your lamb chop.
Yeah, I'll say. All right, thanks, Kath. Interesting
Cheers,
stuff.
Cheers,
Kath. Kath McAleen with the latest in rural news. You can keep up to date right throughout the day by visiting abc.net.au/rural. Coming up next on Bush Telly, we'll have live music from Darren Hanlon.
Religion. It's at the heart of this week's big stories again. In Ukraine, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is rallying nationalistic fervour through the Russian Orthodox Church as an invasion mandate. While in Turkey, corruption allegations against the Prime Minister could see this year's elections take Ataturk's once proudly secular country back to an Islamic state. For the deeper currents under the big stories, that's the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Noel Debien, this afternoon at 5:30.
Singer-songwriter Darren Hanlon's back in the country and, well, he's here, he's visiting a couple of regional towns and rural towns. They're getting the chance to get a preview of his upcoming album, which is due out very soon. He's already been to Wagga and to Sydney, and Darren's taken some time out to drop into the Bush Telly Studios to give us a preview as well. Darren, thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Good to kick off your tour in a regional centre. You've had a show in Wagga. How did that go?
Wagga was great. It's a tough place to do a gig, I found out. Not a lot of bands go there. And you know, I felt ashamed that I hadn't ever played there in my solo career, and all this 13 years of travelling, I hadn't gone there. So I set out to rectify that.
So what, Monday night was your first ever Wagga gig? Wagga gig?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Isn't that shameful?
And it went okay?
It was great. It took a long time to find a venue there because... in all these venues on this tour, we were after real pianos. And so the only place that we were able to find is the college, the Conservatorium of Music, which has a room with a grand piano and some chairs set out. So that was really nice.
Because these are, every one of these shows, and there's only a handful, they're what we'd call them fairly small, intimate shows, really, aren't they?
Yeah, we didn't really want to sell more than 100 tickets at each show. We want to keep it... we want to keep it intimate because this isn't the album tour, and we didn't want people to get confused with that. This is just an excuse to play a lot of these new songs. Also, because there are two Americans visiting, coincidentally, at the moment, and both of them played on the record. So I thought, well, that's a really good excuse to go out on the road for just a few little shows.
Is it still that Darren Hanlon storytelling approach though on this new album?
Some of it is. The songs are getting longer. There's one almost 10-minute song on this album. And it's just solid with chock with words. There's quite a few long songs, story songs.
I'm sure you've been on this program before saying that you'd been told you took too long to get to the chorus as it was. So you obviously haven't listened to that, eh?
Oh, no, and there's not too many choruses. It's probably, it's more of a story album than a pop album, I'd say.
Yeah. Tell me about the writing process, though, because you've been overseas. You've been in the south of the US. How did that inform the material or inspire the material?
It completely informed it. The people that I met... So I started in Nashville, and the only guy that got back to... I sent out a bunch of emails to different studios, and this one guy, Andrea, who recorded the Alabama Shakes record in his house. He's this whiz kid, and since then he's got enough money to have his own studio. And he got back to me straight away and said, oh, I really like what, you know, your songwriting, and I'd love to work with you. And so that was my starting point. And but the only thing, he only had one day in his schedule for the whole year. So I booked that one. Mm-hmm. We did two songs. And then I thought, well, okay, what am I going to do from here? So I bought an Amtrak pass, and I just headed down into Mississippi, and I just met people. It was strange, you know, it was kind of life-affirming, really. It was a wonderful trip. I'd meet someone in one town, and they'd say, well, you go into this next town, you got to meet this person. And it just became this, this great little web of meetings.
So this album, it was a totally organic process, was it? Just throw it out there and see how it develops?
Completely. I wanted to get away from that, the whole business side of things where... You know, you you do put an album out, you tour solely for 3 years, and then you go around again. I just wanted to have a little bit more of an organic approach to it. And I'd actually read this article in a New Yorker about an old guy that had been field recording since the 50s, and he put out a box set on this label Dust to Digital, and it won a Grammy. It was called The Art of Field Recording, and it was a collection of his recordings since the 50s, basically, just different things. Mm. But he still does it. He still goes out there, and he knows where all these people are still living, 90-year-olds that have passed on these folk ballads, not from hearing them on records, but from hearing them from their own families. And anyway, so I was carrying this around. I thought, this is a really beautiful and organic way of looking at music. Just these people that he's recording are making music for the sake of it, not for any business model, you know. It's just part of them. It's part of their fibre. And so I carried this around as a little talisman, I guess, a little touchstone in my backpack. And that was kind of my guide. And it was a funny thing, but I was in a bar in Oxford, Mississippi, and this guy was playing on stage. And I got talking to him after the show, and I said, "They're beautiful folk songs you're playing. What, you know, what's your story?" And he said, "Oh, I grew up field recording in Georgia." And I said, "Do you know Art Rosenbaum? This is the guy, you know, that from the article." He said, "Oh, yeah, he's like my second father. I grew up with him." And he said, "Give him a call." So when I got to Athens, I actually met the guy that I was inspired by. And he took me up into the mountains, and I got to witness some of these old folk traditions.
So you'd use a you'd follow a similar approach again, would you? It didn't turn you off doing it this way?
It's kind of living on the edge. There's a few stressful moments where you're not sure if it's going to work out. But I think I'd definitely do it again. Yeah. I'd like to do it here next time in Australia and just get a van and go around. Because part of this trip also, I started in Broken Hill and started the writing process out there and uncovered, some of the lost music from out there.
What is it about Broken Hill? We've had a few people, a lot of artists that talk about Broken Hill and the inspiration you can get out there.
It's just got an energy. I can't explain it. It's when you're on a train for, you know, 13 hours getting out there, and you don't feel isolated. It's really weird. It feels like a destination. Mm. There's things happening.
Something's going on there. Yeah.
And I think where you know, an energy can be created by a few artists. You know, you can feel it and more come, and yeah, there's a creative thing going on there, and I felt it, yeah.
I remember we had Mojo Juju on not so long back, and she was just saying, "Got to get to Broken Hill and write an album." So there's something there for sure. So where else will be on your agenda around Australia then for the next one? Where haven't you been that you really want to see?
There's lots. I haven't spent much time in rural Victoria or South Australia even. I've spent most of my time in Queensland and New South Wales. So I would just treat it like the American trip and just follow leads. You know, if someone says there's an old guy down lives in 200 miles away that plays the banjo, I'd go and bug him.
Yeah. Get yourself to Portland, Victoria instead of Portland, Oregon for a change, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, the album's, when's it actually due out? Because I had read March initially, and then I'd heard that maybe it was back to May, and we're not really sure at the moment, are we? Do you have a date
for
us?
Somewhere between March and May. It's pretty much ready to go, so it's just a matter now of putting the finishing touches on. Yeah.
All right.
Be ready to go.
Well, can we get a preview? Can we get something off the new album?
Sure. I'd like to play this song. It's a little bit long. Is that all right?
Yeah, go for it. It's is it the 10-minute track or is it a...
No, it's not 10-minute.
All right. That sounds great. What have you got for us?
This is called The Chattanooga Shoot, and it's a true story about when I was travelling on one of the buses over there and it actually literally got shot. It was a drive-by shooting. A car pulled up alongside us on the freeway and opened fire. Mm-hmm. No one was hurt, and I just realised we were outside Chattanooga, and it was too good to pass up, that song title. So here we go.
This is Darren Hanlon live on Bush Telly.
I was far from home and lost and lonely, namelessly bouncing around. Spent too much time and money in this little Georgia town.
But nothing lights a fire just like running out of cash. Well, I had enough to buy a one-way ticket back to Nashville, to a bed I know, owned by a friend who's learned it the hard way. If you invite me in for coffee, I'll unpack my bag and stay. Just like poor Blanche DuBois, I've also come to put my faith in the charity of strangers and honest transportation. So I find myself aboard this silver bullet budget bus, with that creepy guy in sunglasses down the back looking sus, and that old woman with her belongings in a busted plastic bag, and all the nicotine devotees marking time to take a drag. But only just left Chattanooga town, I thought it prudent to sit beside this young and wholesome graduating college student. She was pondering where best to go to do her PhD. She said she had two options, Australia or Italy. I said, well, that's a no-brainer, better come study with us. That's about the time we both heard something hit the bus. Counted six loud popping thuds that came in quick succession. They went, well, that's my impression. I innocently thought it kids just throwing rocks for fun, but that guy sat up the back here, then be shots fired from a gun. Then everyone stopped talking and we all looked at each other, not knowing if to ride ourselves a wheel or duck for cover. Then underneath a small explosion, the engine gave a hellish roar, like when the stick slips out of gear and your foot's flat to the floor. Then the bus lost all control and started swerving across the freeway. Just missed the concrete barrier with about 2 meters leeway. I was seeing gruesome shots they'd used for the morning edition, when someone behind me moaned and we assumed the crash position. Oh my God, I did not know that this was how I was meant to go. I say, oh my God, please save my neck, don't want to die in this burning wreck. But the driver kept her nerve, for she had all our souls to save. She stopped short on the verge of what might have been our grave. Now everybody's thrilled as if they've just been in the movies. They're calling up their family saying, guess what just happened to me? And within 10 minutes flat, soon as you heard the sirens wail, we're hemmed all around by squad cars flashing like Boxing Day sale. Officer Friendly got on board, took out his pad to take some names, patting the heads of children and flirting with the dames. He said, tell me now if any of you've come to any harm. He had John chapter 3:17 tattooed along his arm. He said, you can go stretch your legs now, you might be sitting for some time. So I jumped off with the smokers and from there surveyed the crime. The first shot, it glazed off the flank. The second barely missed the tank. The third shot went right through and lodged into the restroom door. The fourth shot pierced the luggage lock. The fifth shot struck the engine block. Then the sixth shot popped the tire and then it shredded to the core. After a while, little bits of the story filtered through. The shooter had been local. The cops, they now knew who. He was supposed to join the bus back at the Chattanooga station. He was late and tried to wave the driver down, but she's impatient. She's bent to her position and a timetable to honor. So he tailed us to the freeway and let the bullets rain upon her. Oh my God, how close we've come to marching toward your gumdrum. I said, oh my God, how close we've been to staring down at eternity. When the last cop pulled away, we had been stuck out there for hours. Didn't take too long till the collective mood it sours. See my student friend, she's wailing that she's now gonna be late. She's gonna have to call ahead and cancel tonight's date. I said, feel lucky you're not dead. You're really giving me the blues. And the next day, safe in Nashville, it didn't even make the news. In the history of America, it was just another day. Now I've made it to that warm bed, in there all day I'll stay. And if you ever find yourself riding the bus round Chattanooga, keep your eyes open for pockets with an outline like a Luger. Cause what worries me the most is that it's difficult to tell if you should fear those who have missed the bus or them who's punctual.
Brand new from Darren Hanlon, the track's Chattanooga Shoot Shoot. You're listening to Bush Telly. Darren, pretty upbeat song for a terrifying experience. Six bullets.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm working on that. I actually had to edit it. The song went a lot longer.
I wanted to know more about the bloke up the back, the creepy guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's always one of those on the Greyhound or wherever.
So that's the shortened version. Look, I better let you go because I know you've got a show on, but people can catch you regionally in Candalo this Friday night, and there's also shows in Canberra to come and Melbourne. If people visit your website, they'll find out more there. Darren, all the best with this preview tour, and we look forward to the album release, which will be Where Do You Come From, out sometime between now and May, and let us know when you're touring around Australia next and try and catch up for a chat again.
Thanks a lot.
That's Darren Hanlon. You're listening to Bush Telly. You're on RN. Let's talk food safety. You would hope that the food you put in your mouth is fairly safe, basically that it won't make you sick. So who do you trust to make sure that's the case, especially when it comes to imported food? Recently, you might have heard our story about food safety concerns in China, where there are issues of melamine-contaminated baby food, or there has been in the past. There's been issues of exploding watermelons and cadmium-laced rice. Here's a reminder of what Professor Josephine Smart from the Department of Anthropology at the University of Calgary had to say.
The import regulation is imposed by your government. The Chinese product must meet your government's requirement for food safety standards. And I trust that your government also regularly check the imports to catch things that might not be quite up to standard. So you just have to trust your government to do the right thing for the consumers in Australia. The government is the first gatekeeper in food safety.
There you go. Just trust the government. Josephine got us wondering exactly what standards are applied here and who's checking our food on our behalf. Should we be confident or are we being a little complacent? Well, Peter Lena can tell us more. Peter heads the Cargo and Shipping Branch in the Border Compliance Division in the Department of Agriculture. Hi, Peter. Thanks for joining Bush Telly.
Thank you very much, Cameron.
I saw some figures just out this week that about 300 tonnes of apples from China came into Australia last year. What types of checks would, say, fresh apples undergo?
Look, all food coming into Australia is checked to make sure that they comply with both our quarantine requirements. So that's the first hurdle they have to go through. And then they have to meet all of our requirements that are legislated in the Australia-New Zealand Food Standards Code.
So that's the things that like chemicals that we might think make us
absolutely
sick, that type of thing.
Okay. That's right. Residues of chemicals, bacterial, microbiological risks, etc.
What's your division actually looking for, though?
We run a program. I'm responsible for the imported food program, and we have a legislative requirement to look at imported food coming into Australia to make sure they comply with Australian standards. We have two broad groups of foods that we look at. We look at the risk foods. These are the ones that have got a high risk of either a microbiological food safety risk. They'd be things like cooked chicken meat, pig meat, unprocessed or uncooked processed meat, cured hams, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Crustaceans, prawns, that sort of stuff. We look at things that have natural contaminants, so tuna and mackerel, where there's a risk of histamine contamination. We look at things that have biotoxins in them, so some some of the clams, scallops and oysters we test for, pistachios, peanuts and other nut products. We look at things that might have environmental contamination. So some of the seaweeds where you're worried about high levels of iodine or arsenic or some other byproducts of the processing. So we look at all of those high-risk foods. We look at 100% of those coming
every one of
the
them. So if I'm standing in one of the big supermarkets and there's, say, the prawns from Southeast Asia, those prawns would have been tested, would they?
That's absolutely right. What we do, however, because we don't have the entire Australian population standing at the border checking, being able to check things, what we do is we have a risk-based system. So when we have a high-risk food coming in, we initially look at 100% of consignments for the first five consignments. If we don't find any problems whatsoever by then, we then look at 25% of consignments for the next 100 consignments. And then thereafter, we reduce it down to 5% and only look at 5%. But we do that on the basis that the initial testing and the initial approaches has given us a great deal of confidence that the particular supplier and the particular importer know what they're doing and they are bringing in safe food that meets all of our requirements.
So when you say consignment, that is from a supplier or a import or
an
importer?
That's right. Absolutely. We look at the supply chain and we test the supply chain. And if at any time we find a problem with any of the product, we then go back and say, okay, well, you're back to 100% testing until you rebuild a level of confidence that you're actually meeting all of our requirements again.
Okay, so to come back to my initial example of apples, that being a fresh food, that would go through the 100% initial test, would it?
It would be. They would look at it for compliance with our quarantine requirements, all the biosecurity elements.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's a low-risk product, we would look at 5% of them.
Okay.
So from a food safety perspective, but 100% of them would be looked at from a quarantine perspective.
Okay. Yes. So you have to draw that distinction between the quarantine risk and the food safety.
That's right. And apples are generally safe. When we test a product like apples, because they use agricultural chemicals on the production, we have a screen of some 69 chemicals that we apply to those sorts of products looking for residues. And if we find residues in excess of what's permitted here, then the food's not allowed entry.
Mm-hmm.
And we then check the next five consignments to make sure that they are compliant thereafter.
So this is how you get around the issue that some pesticides, herbicides may be banned in Australia but permitted in other countries?
Well, they still have to meet our requirements for residues. You've got to remember that pesticides in Australia are not necessarily banned. There are a small number that are banned. But the reason why we have pesticides here is that they support agricultural production in the Australian context. So, for instance, we have a fairly dry climate, so we don't have a huge problem with fungus on some of our products, and therefore we have a limited range of fungicides that we may need for agricultural production and which are therefore registered for use in Australia, whereas in other climates they have far more problems with that and they would have a greater array and a greater requirement for the use of those sorts of chemicals in agricultural production.
Okay. Peter Liner is who you're hearing from. He's from the Cargo and Shipping Branch of the Border Compliance Division, and that's at the Department of Agriculture. And we're talking about the sort of food safety and quarantine tests that imported food into Australia actually go through. Peter, I'll come back to you in a moment, but I spoke earlier with Patrick Lepissier, who is a food importer. He's been importing product to Australia for about 30 years. Imports lots of chocolate and fine foods, generally for chefs and food manufacturers in Australia, and I wanted to get his view on the inspection process.
Well, it first goes to custom, and custom has a registry of products that, following documentation that we supply, and is allowed to is able to let a product through mm-hmm. without any question, or to highlight those that could have a high risk, and then this is passed on to ACIS, the Australian quarantine inspection services, which will take it a step further.
Okay, so there's a clear distinction, is there, between safe products generally and risky products?
Absolutely.
Mm. What's an example of each?
Well, for instance, if you bring a preserve that has been sterilized, you know, for so many hours and has got a shelf life of, say, 4 or 5 years, and it can sit on the shelf, that is very safe. So you bring baked beans, for instance, that is very safe. You won't have a risk. So you know that that's going to go through no problem. Now, if you bring, like we do, cocoa powder, we know that each time we will have an inspection. We know that.
That's just the rule.
It is the rule, and that's fine. And I do understand it more now that I have been to Costa Rica recently and visited some plantations and processes, and spent time at the university there where there's a program in research to disease in cocoa beans.
So is that what the inspection is for, disease in particular?
Yes, and this one in particular, this one which is called a black rot, is present only in South America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fear is that these diseases will be transmitted around the world, which means it could wipe out the cocoa industry.
So you have these categories of products, some that you know will go straight through, some that are going to be inspected every time, and then there's this third group that sometimes will be held up and sometimes won't.
Correct, yes.
Mm. So what types of products do you get the surprise with? What sort of products sometimes go through, no inspection at all, and then another time might get held up for weeks?
Okay, I think you want to talk about dairy product. Mm. this is a tricky one, and it can be confusing. There is there probably a bit of a lack of consistency in the application of the rules, and that can be difficult for importers to comprehend. And some clarification needs to be made, perhaps, and to make it a bit easier for those importers who want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them do. All the serious importers want things to be done properly.
Dairy products or products containing a manufactured dairy component in them are held up, what are they actually being inspected for? What's the concern?
The concern is milk in general, milk, egg, cream, origin of the milk. Essentially, that's what it is. Countries, they've got a disease. So we have less of a problem with Switzerland. However, then the processing of the milk is still questioned as to what temperature has it been.
The pasteurization
temperature, mm-hmm. how long, and the whole process after that.
This is because we're so skeptical of what the French do with their cheeses and their milks in Australia, isn't it?
Correct. But having said that, I see French butter here. I see Spanish ham here. And I say, well, I don't quite understand this.
You see some inconsistencies?
Well, to me, it's a little bit... Okay, I'm sure that all that comes within the rules, but very tricky.
Patrick Lepizier is a food importer here in Australia, been doing the job for about 30 years or so. Also with me is Peter Liner. Peter's the head of cargo and shipping at the Border Compliance Division at the Department of Agriculture. Peter, why would someone like Patrick see what he says is an inconsistency, particularly around the import of dairy products?
Okay. The issue that he's contending with there is the fact that those products have to meet our quarantine requirements, which is essentially about the pests and diseases that may be associated with a product and the degree of processing and what that means in terms of controlling those diseases and the risks that they pose to our agricultural production. So that's the first hurdle that he has to get through.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is that they then have to meet our food safety and food standards requirements. So when he talks about products getting through without being looked at, they're generally the things where there is no quarantine risk whatsoever associated with the product. And they're highly processed, and so they get through. They, in fact, are referred to our department, but they're one of those low-risk products where we look at 5% on a random basis, and it may mean that his particular stream has been part of that 95% that comes straight in.
Okay, I understand.
When you're looking at the products which have a biosecurity risk, a quarantine risk, We look at 100% of those, and we have significant rules around how we manage that. Mm. So for dairy and egg, we allow for small amounts of processed product in processed food, but if it's a significant amount, then we have to consider the diseases that may be associated with it.
A lot to consider from there. Peter, we'll have to leave it there. Look, thank you for joining us. It's been most interesting. Appreciate it. Peter Liner is head of the Cargo and Shipping Branch in the Border Compliance Division at the Department of Agriculture. That's Bush Telly for today. See you at the same time tomorrow. You're on RN.
Stephen Mayne, a Qantas shareholder, wondered out loud on Saturday Extra about what's really underway in the current public drama.
Unions are saying we can't see where the job cuts are. And frankly, if there really are 5,000 jobs to go without butchering the service, well, why wasn't that done a few years ago if there's these obvious efficiencies there? So I think there is a bit of a game of chicken going on with the government and with the unions.
Hear all that he says by downloading from the RN website.